Today is Thursday, July 14th, 2005. We're on campus of Michigan State University in East Lansing. I'm Jeff Charnley interviewing Steve Mouche for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of Michigan State, which we're commemorating this year in 2005. As you can see, Mr. Mouche, we have a tape recorder here for this oral history. Do you give us permission to do this interview?
Yes, I do.
I'd like to start first with just some general educational and professional background and training. Where were you born and raised before college?
In Dayton, Ohio.
Okay. And where did you go do your, or where did you go to high school?
Kettering High School in Dayton, in Kettering, Ohio, which is right outside Dayton.
Okay. Was there any particular high school teacher or parent that had an influence on you in terms of education?
Oh, I had. Yes, there was one in particular. Her name was Leah Funk. And she was the drama teacher and debate coach. And I was on the debate team. And we traveled virtually every weekend all over the state. And she was an amazing person because we spent about half of our day in her class because she taught us everything, but she taught us all the things that we needed to get done rapidly so we could spend all our time focusing on preparation for debate. And then there were the kids in there who were doing the drama stuff too. And we won the Ohio State Debate Championships 2 years in a row.
Wow, that's excellent.
She was quite a person, and she never slept.
Really?
She did not have a bed.
Oh, is that right?
In her house. Oh. She would nap occasionally on her sofa.
Mm, that's amazing. did she encourage you to go into broadcasting? Or
no, actually she didn't. I worked for a junior achievement company that was a radio broadcasting company. Junior achievement at the time, you know, they did everything. Kids would sell commercials, other ones would, you know, do the announcing and stuff. And we had a mentor at this radio station who was our advisor. And I did editorials, which was pretty funny at the time. But it was a big band station.
Okay.
So my beginnings in radio were working at a big band station.
Mm-hmm. And this was in what year?
This was in
your high school years?
In the 60s, 62. I graduated in 62.
Okay.
58, 62.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Ella Fitzgerald, mm-hmm. Count Basie, Duke Ellington, mm-hmm. You know, all that stuff.
Did you learn much about some of the mechanics of radio at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
I did.
Mm-hmm. How was it that you came to Michigan State?
I wanted to be either a forester or in broadcasting.
Okay.
And so I chose three schools that had strong programs in both. I thought I wanted to be a forester because I was a shy person, I thought, and really would be much happier working with trees than people was the idea. Mm-hmm. But then I came here for the summer orientation and discovered how much math and science you had to have to be in forestry and changed my major to broadcasting before I even came to school here.
Uh-huh. So the fall of 62 was when you came?
Yes.
Okay. Why would you, what were some of your early impressions of Michigan State?
First of all, having been born and raised in Ohio, it was a different state, and I guess when you're that young, that's somewhat different because you're not as used to it. But my early impressions, I think, were initially some awe about the size of the place. But I certainly remember having terrific times with the friends I met in the dorm, and there was only one other person from my high school who came to Michigan State, mm-hmm. since we were out-of-state students. Mm-hmm. And so I did not have a preference for a roommate, so I, you know, it was luck of the draw. Mm-hmm. And they tripled us, which they still do, mm-hmm. I think, in Shaw Hall. So there were three of us in a little room in Shaw Hall, and we either had to be really friendly or else things weren't going to work out very well. Yeah.
The So the normal rivalry between Ohio State and Michigan State, you were right in the middle of that.
So I was never much into the Ohio State thing anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So didn't betray any family confidences or anything like that. Some of the undergraduate, how was there anything that you, so when you switched your major from forestry, tell me again what you went into at that time?
It was called television, radio, and film.
Okay, all right.
At the time.
All right. And the School of Communication Arts and Sciences was that part of that?
Yes, it had been in existence at that point.
Okay.
In fact, I think it's one of the oldest in the country.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
About to celebrate their 50th anniversary this fall, I think.
Okay. Did you have any contact with Gordon Sabine at that time?
No, not much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I knew who he was, of course.
Yeah. In the 1960s, while you were here as an undergraduate, in what ways did you get involved in broadcasting?
Well, I was working at the radio station in Shaw Hall. There were radio stations in a lot of the dormitories on campus. They were what were called the old closed circuit stations, where they broadcast over the electrical wiring in the building. It was awful quality, but I actually ended up being the manager of the station in Shaw Hall. And then I was also working at the one in Brody Hall as well, and then I got a job at WKAR in my freshman year, working there. So I was playing radio a lot.
Mm-hmm. What was it, music mainly, or were you doing interviews or talking?
Yeah, it was, it was 60s rock and roll, early 60s rock and roll at the dorm stations.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have this big old clunky console that had turntables built into it and speakers, and we'd roll it out into the lower level of Shaw Hall and have big dances every Friday night. There would be hundreds of MSU students who would come, and so I would spend my nights helping run the Shaw Hall dance on Friday nights. But at WKAR, because it was a professional radio station and it was very labor intensive at the time, so announcers did nothing but announce. So you had to have somebody operate the control board and play the records and play the music. And then there had to be another separate person, an engineer, at the transmitter to control the transmitter. So it was very labor intensive. The music was mostly classical music, and I did not know anything about classical music. My background having been my family's interest in big band music in the station I worked at in Dayton, and then the 60s rock at the campus stations. So my first job at WKAR was as a control board operator for the announcers. So all I did was play the music and turn the microphones on and take cues from the announcers. And I spent, obviously, a lot of time listening to them announce classical music. And after a while, I think it probably was only maybe my first year, maybe even less, I had learned the classical music because I was subjected to it constantly sitting across the window from the announcers, that I took the audition. They had a rigorous audition at the time.
Oh, really?
We had a great blooper tape of kids who took the auditions and all the different ways they mispronounced all the classical composer names.
It was a linguist.
It was pretty funny.
A European linguist today.
So I took the announcer audition and got promoted to an announcer.
Where was the station at that time?
It was in the auditorium building. We were crammed in, literally, to the fourth floor, third floor, and then overflowed into the second floor, which is really the balcony level of the auditorium. So the offices on the second floor were essentially storage closets under the balcony seats.
Not exactly designed for...
No air conditioning, and the windows didn't open. Up there on the fourth floor.
Mm-hmm. And that was the main offices for quite a few years, wasn't it?
Until 1981.
Until
1981. When we moved into the Communication Arts Building.
What was that like?
Oh, that was like heaven. there was like just heaven. Mm. It was an amazing facility that was designed by one of the greatest known acoustical studio designers in the country at the time. Mm-hmm. And going from studios in the auditorium building that literally had windows in them, so you could hear buses going by, we ended up in studios that were acoustically outstanding. Mm-hmm. And and I always felt at the time, because buildings, you know, I think they still do, have to be built to state specifications, which means no Taj Mahals, but I thought they did a really nice job of creating an attractive building, which now needs some work, but mm-hmm. that was 1981 and today is 2005.
Yeah, 24 years. who were some of the, you remember some of the announcers when you were, or were they students or were they paid staff?
It was a mixture of students and paid staff. There were announcers who I felt at the time were just really, really good, and I lost track of them. I don't know where they went on to be. I do know that when I was a student, there were three students who were in classes with me, and two of whom worked at the station who went on to be pretty famous as broadcasters. One of them was Susan Spencer, who was an anchor person and news reporter for CBS Television Network. Another one was Jay Johnson, who left here and worked at a number of stations, but ended up as a legendary NBC local news anchor in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But then got elected to Congress and became a congressman. And he was in Congress for only one term.
One term.
And then lost, that probably would have been the first Bush election, perhaps, because I think he just got lost in a Republican landslide. He was a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And ended up, strangely enough, being appointed by the Republican administration to be director of the U.S. Mint.
Hmm. Interesting.
And he was there for a little while, and now he still lives in the Washington area and is doing consulting work.
Mm-hmm. So you've had some contact with him or maintained?
Actually, yes, I did. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. And he was here working at the station, which I suspect we'll get to later, mm-hmm. during all the student Vietnam War protests. And one time, about 10 years ago, he did a whole series for the Green Bay station about Vietnam War and being on a campus at the time, and he brought his TV crew down here for a weekend, and we spent a weekend walking around campus and sitting on the porch of the auditorium building telling stories about what it was like working at the MSU station during the Vietnam War protest.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Are those tapes still in existence? Or
I have, and I need to listen to it because it may have fallen to pieces by mm-hmm. now, an audio tape from February of whatever year that was. It was extremely cold. Mm-hmm. We had one portable tape recorder. It weighed a lot, really, really heavy. And I went out to cover what you could probably characterize them as riots, mm-hmm. student riots on Grand River Avenue. Students were breaking the store windows. The state police were there in their riot gear. And I recorded this, street scene. And all I remember is the recorder was very heavy. It was extremely cold. And I got clubbed in the back by a state policeman. And I do want to listen to that tape. I do have that.
Well, that sounds like a priceless treasure, Dad.
It'll probably be awful when I listen to it.
Well, slice of life from an interesting period. Yeah. How did the Vietnam War affect the radio station?
Well, it was interesting because we just missed that as students. You know, we were just out of school and working at the station at the time. And so it was more our job to be onlookers and cover it rather than to participate. Mm-hmm. But it was a tumultuous time on campus, obviously. And there were protests that would break out all over the place, sit-ins at the administration building and demonstrations. And that was all mixed in that same era of the 60s with the riots in Detroit and, you know, the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King. It was an incredibly interesting, unfortunate time in many respects, but it was quite an interesting time to be involved in a news gathering operation mm-hmm. with what little resources we had at the mm-hmm. time.
Mm-hmm. Were there did the station cover any of the major demonstrations or anything like that?
Yes, we did, and we were doing a lot of long form stuff at the time, major addresses. We actually used to broadcast a lecture or a class or a speaker on campus every day at 10 o'clock in the morning. In fact, I think this program was called On Campus. And so if there were events that were related to the war or other current events, those would appear in a long form. It was almost like the C-SPAN mm-hmm. of the 60s on radio at the time.
Hmm. Interesting. How did the professors respond to that?
To the program?
Yeah.
Well, it was a strange time because for programming that particular radio station, because in the 60s there was no NPR. Mm-hmm. NPR didn't come along until 1970. We had limited off-campus resources for news, just an old clickety-clack Associated Press news wire. And we had to make do with what we had here. And the other thing that was most fascinating was that we didn't have audience ratings. We couldn't tell how many people listened to programs. And frankly, we didn't care, because we felt that it wasn't our job to reach as many people as possible like the commercial stations, because we weren't selling commercials. Mm-hmm. We were doing no fundraising whatsoever. We were 100% paid for by the university. And so in a perverse kind of way, it was like we broadcast what we thought people ought to hear mm-hmm. rather than what people necessarily really wanted to hear, which was what the commercial stations were doing. Mm-hmm. It was a very different time.
Mm-hmm. The transition from an ag school to a major research university, which many people would say was accomplished during the 50s and early 60s, were you doing agricultural programming in that time?
Oh, indeed we were. We had a full-time farm director and a full-time woman's director, and we had a daily show called the Farm Service Hour, and it was every day at noon. I think it was an hour and a half for a while, but then it was mostly an hour when I was there, and it was every day at noon because, you remember the logic, the farmer gets up early, goes out, works hard in his field, and comes in for a big hearty lunch at noontime. Turns on the radio because he must have the Farm Service Hour. Mm-hmm. And it was almost a formula show where, you know, if it's Thursday, it will be so-and-so, the Eaton County Cooperative Extension Director, who will come in and tell you whether you should plant your corn now or not. And that went on for a long, long time. And it was the program won a lot of awards. And, but eventually, people realized that farmers didn't necessarily have that big hearty lunch at noon, and nobody really needed to tell them when their soybeans needed to be planted, because
they knew.
They had finally figured that part out. So the old Farmers Week here, oh, that was a big deal for the radio station. You know, wall-to-wall coverage, as they say.
And that was during spring break, wasn't it, usually?
Yeah, so, yeah.
When the students were gone. And
the auditorium building where the radio stations were would be just jam-packed with future farmers of America. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of them for their little annual meeting during Farmers Week. Mm-hmm. We have their old historical pictures of farm show things on the radio station, and one of my favorites is one of the farm directors interviewing a cow. Now, we used to get, I remember getting letters from farmers saying that they played the radio station in their dairy barn because it really soothed their cows. And they liked, the cows liked
help
the
milk
classical
production.
Music.
Well, I guess there was some merit in that.
It would be interesting to know what the Homemakers Hour programs consisted of.
Uh-huh.
Because
you weren't involved in that.
I don't quite remember that, but you know, there was a full-time woman's director, and there was a show called The Homemakers Hour that I remember in its waning years. The Homemakers Hour was 15 minutes long. but boy, I'll bet if you listen to it today, it wouldn't be complying with today's equal rights. I'm sure it was very, now ladies, remember when your man comes home. I mean, I'm making this up.
Yeah.
But,
Human Ecology, what became Human Ecology, did that have, College of Human Ecology, have any role of that, or was that Cooperative Extension Service?
No, there was a relationship between Cooperative Extension and the farm show. And in fact, they paid for part of it. Or part of the cost of the salary of the person for at least a while. And there was also a relationship between the woman's editor and the Human Ecology. Wasn't called Human Ecology, then it was Home Ec, wasn't
Home Ec,
it?
Yeah.
My wife is a Home Ec graduate.
I forgot to ask about the station. Was this the AM station at that time, or?
Well, interestingly enough, the AM station went on the air in 1922. Mm-hmm. And again, if we're going back to the 60s, the early 60s, the FM station went on in 1948, which is unbelievable, because nobody in the 1960s, hardly anybody had an FM radio. Mm-hmm. You didn't, if you bought a radio, it didn't even have FM on it. The FM listening in the country was really small compared to AM listening. Mm-hmm. I mean, AM radio was dominant. There's a dramatic graph that shows when the crossover finally took place, where the AM just kept going down and the FM went up to the point where today probably 80% or at least 80% of all listening must be to FM radio as opposed to AM. Mm-hmm. So there was this WKR FM station that went on the air in 1948, and nobody could listen to it. My first FM radio was living in the dorm, working at WKR, and wanting to be able to hear the FM station, and I went out and bought a converter device to attach to an old tape recorder to play it through the speaker in my tape recorder, because you could not literally You could not buy an FM, AM, FM radio at the time.
Wow.
So what WKAR did was they simulcast everything. Mm-hmm. The AM station could only be on the air from sunrise to sunset. Mm-hmm. And so they just played everything that was on the AM station was also simultaneously on mm-hmm. the FM station.
And that restriction still applies, doesn't it?
The sunrise to sunset.
With the AM sunrise to sunset.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that an FCC rule?
It is the goofiest rule. It has to do with the fact that AM radio waves bounce off the ionosphere and travel huge distances at night. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid and we used to go to Canada every summer, it was one of my pastimes, seeing how many distant radio stations I could listen to. And boy, when you were up north, could you ever get stations from all over, AM stations mm-hmm. from all over mm-hmm. the United States. Mm-hmm. And I used to do that too when I was in, you know, high school and stuff. I was always a radio junkie. Wait till nighttime and, you know, listen to my favorite shows in Virginia or, you know, Philadelphia or something. So it was because of this stations going this long distance that the FCC made stations that shared channels, some of them, not be on at night. Mm-hmm. And so the reason WKRAM had to go off was to protect WWL in New Orleans.
New Orleans, yeah.
And at one time we tried to figure out a way to be able to stay on after dark, and we hired consultants, did research, who showed that we would have to protect WWL's signal to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we could only be on the air if our signal wouldn't go further than Fort Wayne, Indiana, which it certainly would do at its daytime power at night. Mm-hmm. When I worked at the station in Dayton, that was the big band station, the Junior Achievement Company, they were a daytime station, and their sign-off used to say, due to an archaic and ridiculous FCC rule, it is now time for WAVI to leave the air. And I always thought, boy, you're flaunting this one. We never did that here.
You were probably tempted, though.
Right. But the notion was, it was a wartime uh-huh. thing, too. The notion was that you needed to hear those big, powerful stations mm-hmm. if you were in a rural area. Mm-hmm. And that was the only way to reach these rural areas, because there weren't very many radio stations then compared mm-hmm. to today. Mm-hmm.
And WKAR, or no, those weren't the original call letters, were they?
Those are the only call letters I know of.
Okay, or WKAR.
All people right. ask how, what do they mean? Mm-hmm. Who came up with them? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get asked that question all the time. And the answer to the question is, they were randomly assigned by the FCC.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, they could have been changed. Mm-hmm. Today it's these rock and roll stations change their call letters about every week. You know, mm-hmm. it's not hard to change your call letters. Mm-hmm. And once or twice, you know, somebody would get an idea at MSU. One time it was a Board of Trustees member, but I don't remember who it was, that we should have the call letters WMSU. Mm-hmm. And I always argued that WKAR was of such historical significance and being one of the oldest, not the oldest, but one of the very oldest educational radio stations in the country, that those call letters should be preserved. I almost lost that battle once, but it turned out that WMSU was not available because it was owned by Mississippi State University.
Yeah. Yeah. Montana State, I know.
I never told anybody that mm-hmm. if MSU really wanted those call letters and they made an offer to Mississippi State University, mm-hmm. you can buy them. They could be paid to change their call letters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I felt so strongly that they are of such great historical significance that they need to remain that way. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, when the TV station went on the air, it went on the air with the call letters WMSB, mm-hmm. Michigan State Broadcasting.
Okay.
Well, guess what they are now.
Yeah.
And have been for years.
WKAR. When was that switch made? Do you remember from your research?
The call letters?
Yes.
No, I don't.
We can look that up.
Probably when they switched from the shared agreement with Channel 10. They shared time with Channel 10 and then switched to Channel 23 full-time.
Okay. Were you involved at that time?
I was not involved.
You were doing radio.
With TV. Mm-hmm. I was involved with TV in that we did some things together. And people like the sports department, Jim Adams, Terry Braverman, they worked at both TV and radio. And there was also some of the news, there was a news relationship too. We shared a program guide for a while after we started fundraising. But I didn't become really involved in TV until 1989.
Mm-hmm. Was the frequency 870? That was always the one that we do.
Well, it might not have been 870 in the very, very beginning, because in the very, very beginning it was experimental.
Okay.
It was a bunch of electrical engineering students who didn't care about programming. They just mm-hmm. cared about being able to transmit radio waves.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time there may not have even, the call signs were not, I don't believe they were three or four letters. Mm-hmm. They were letters and numbers or mm-hmm. something.
Oh, I see. Yeah, in the early stages.
And we actually have the early logs.
Oh, really?
Where, you know, they would sign on at noon and broadcast for 5 minutes and then sign off.